It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
And welcome to another Scouting Post podcast with the Three Amigos. This is your host, Kirk Ludeke. I'm joined by Dominic Tiano, Reed Duthie, and we have a special guest, Boston Bruins prospect and newest contract recipient, Jesse Gabriel of the Prince George Cougars of the Western Hockey League. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Okay, guys. So we're excited. We debuted our guest series with Tori Krug. Now Jesse Gabriel is following up. That's a high bar to set, Jesse, but we know you can clear it coming off of a 40-goal season, and you've already got 19 this season. But I think what I'll do is stop talking and pitch it over to my co-hosts to go ahead and kind of chat with you a bit. So, again, thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, Jesse, congrats on the contract. Originally, you were supposed to join us last week, and then this came up, so can you tell us a little bit about the process, how it went down, and how quickly it came to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, when I got back here in Prince George, I wasn't really focused on when or if I'd get a contract. I just wanted to come back and have a good year and play the way I could and try to put all my training into the kind of gameplay. And I was here, just in having some breakfast before leaving, and I got a text from Jamie Langbrenner, and he said it was going to be a good day, so I kind of thought that was maybe a good sign, and went to the rink and talked to him about my coach, or with my coach, Richard Matichuk, and it wasn't pre-planned. Like, I didn't really know anything about it. I just went to the rink, and it was kind of talking about it there, so it just kind of came out of nowhere. It was really exciting, and it was a great feeling getting it before Christmas.
Well, absolutely. That's like having something gift-wrapped under the tree. And now that you're signed on with the Bruins, you're focused on your WHL season. 40 goals a year ago, as Kirk said. You've already got 19 this season, Jesse. One thing that I've talked to a lot of scouts about, I work in the Ontario Hockey League, and a lot of scouts have told me that they wouldn't want you in this league because they think you'd be an absolute nightmare to play against. Your all-around game, your gritty style, with the goal-scoring ability. What has it been like to have this kind of success in the WHL and now seeing yourself potentially as a Boston Bruin moving forward? Well, what is that feeling like?
It's a really good feeling. I put the work in the summer, and I think for me, obviously, the OHL is a high scoring league. The WHL is a little different. It's not as much goal scoring. It's more of a grinders league, if you want to put it that way. But getting the chances here, last year my coaches, gave me a good chance to be successful, and I cashed in with the opportunity. And this year, my new coach Richard and our two new assistant coaches, they're giving me all the opportunities to be successful, and I'm just buying in with their system, and it's going well. Things are clicking, and my alignments are great. They've been changing around, from time to time, but my teammates are a big part of my success, and as a result, we're doing well as a team because we're all buying into the system. And I think Boston, they saw that I was having a good year, and I took in, they're kind of what they wanted me to be better at, and I think they maybe appreciated it, and getting rewarded, it's a huge honor being a part of the Bruins organization fully now, and going forward now I just want to make everyone do the right things and make them all happy and do what they want me to do now.
Jesse, I go back to the draft and seeing you right after you put on the Bruins sweater for the first time, and just how an obviously emotional moment that had to be for you and for your family and for everyone that has had a hand in your growth and your progress. But if you could kind of talk to the fans a little bit about what you were going through as you sat in Sunrise, and you know, what your expectations were going in, and just what the overall experience was like up until the moment that you heard your name called, and then, you know, what followed for you. Just, you know, talk to your experience as a player and what that was like for you being drafted by the team that you cheered for and in your heart were really hoping would call your name.
Yeah, I mean, for the fans, you know, obviously for every team when someone gets drafted, they say it's a huge honor to, you know, be a part of any organization. But, you know, for me, you know, when they do the scouting, you know, when they send out the papers at the start of the year and they ask, like, who your favorite player is, who your favorite team is, mine was Brad Marchand and the Bruins. I genuinely wanted to be a Bruin and was hoping that Boston would pick me up because I thought that, you know, it was a really good fit and I liked the way that they play, and I thought I could, that they could help me mold me into the best player I could be. And so when I went to the combine, you know, that interview with Boston was the best by far. It had, you know, we were clicking definitely the best in that interview. And, you know, I was getting along great with all the management and everyone in the organization during that process. And the regional scouts in the WHL came up to me after and said that I knocked it out of the park. And, you know, it was just a great feeling knowing that, you know, my favorite team growing up was, you know, they liked me a lot in that process. So when I got to the draft, it was, you know, I wanted to be a Bruin. Obviously getting drafted was the goal, but, you know, deep down I did want to be a Boston Bruin and be drafted by that team. So, you know, at that moment, you know, it was a stressful night. And, you know, for me, I just wanted to get it done as quick as possible because, you know, sitting around it gets really, you know, I get a lot of anxiety going. So once I got picked by the Bruins, it was a huge relief for me because that's the team I wanted to be with. And, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way going back. I wouldn't want to change that day one bit. It was just a dream come true.
Jesse, speaking as a Bruins fan at heart, I mean, I think Bruins fans, when they get a chance to see you in action, they are going to absolutely take to your game like no other fan base. I think you're going to be a beloved figure in Boston before too long. But you mentioned your favorite player being Brad Marchand. Do you really model your game after his as well? Because from the video I've seen of you, you've got the speed, you've got the goal scoring, the talent, and you can get under other players' skin, and you use that to your advantage. Is that something that you try to learn a little bit from Brad as you go along?
Yeah, actually, when I was in Providence last year, you know, I had a great conversation with him. He was there, you know, getting some skates in for the World Cup or the overseas there, the whatever he went there for. He played for Team Canada.
World Championship.
World Championships, and we had a great conversation. He was kind of, I told him that he was the guy I modeled my game after, so. You know, he kind of was flattered by it and gave me some great advice and said, you know, you gotta, you know, in this organization, they like guys like that, but they really want you to find the line. And so, you know, I kind of took that to heart. And, you know, that's something in my game that, you know, obviously as a young player, you still haven't, you know, mastered it, but it's getting better. And, you know, to even get compared to a guy like Brad, it's a huge honor because he's obviously successful in the NHL. If I could be, you know, a type of player like him, when I'm his age, I would just be, you know, a dream come true. And I hope that the Bruins fans, you know, appreciate guys like that. I know that they love him, and if I can, you know, be like him, that's, you know, that would just be great.
You're bigger than Brad, though. Come on, be honest. You said you met him, so you know you're a little bigger than Brad, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bigger. I mean, he's got some amazing skills. So there's a lot of work to be done for me to you know, be in that same category as him. But yeah, you know, I'm a little bigger, but I think we do play similar. I might have a little size on him, but I think we play similar games. And you know, the skill for me is gonna, you know, it's gonna be a process for the next few years. But I think I could play like him when, you know, when I'm his age. If I, you know, I'm gonna keep the same work ethic in the summer and during the season. So I think a comparison like that for me is a huge honor. But I do think that it's in my reach to get that if I keep working as hard as I am.
And Jesse, you got to add that loved by Bruin fans like Brad are goals side by side with hated by the rest of the league, which isn't a bad thing, yeah. Right?
Yeah, no, I mean that's kind of, you know, some guys might not like that sort of attention being, you know, considered the most hated guy in the league or one of them, but I think that is the kind of a test. And, you know, if I could be the most hated guy in the league, that's almost a, you know, an advantage for me because, you know, when you go into, even in this league, when you go into another team's barn and you got, you know, say you go to the box or something, you got fans leaning over the glass, you know, saying things to a 19-year-old kid that, you know, you wouldn't really expect. It's kind of, it's funny and kind of gratifying at the same time because I kind of pride myself on getting guys off their game and even if I can get fans kind of doing that, it's kind of funny. So it's something that I definitely want to keep in my game, and I want, you know, Boston to, you know, help me find the right line and, you know, ride it as much as possible without going over it, overboard too much.
And it is a compliment in a way when fans of opposing teams are like that. But I wanted to ask you, Jeremy Lauzon, in an interview last week with Craig Eagle, said, mentioned you as one of the players that he tries to keep in touch with. And being how deep the prospect pool is in Boston, and you're going to be playing with a lot of these guys, are you keeping in touch with anybody in particular in terms of prospects?
No one in particular. I mean, that prospect group, that draft class, you know, it's got a bunch of not only amazing hockey players, but just amazing guys, you know, going to the development camps and training camps with them. It's a lot of fun, not just, you know, with the competition off the ice, but or on the ice, but, you know, just being friends off the ice, you know, guys with Brandon Carlo and Jake DeBrusk, guys who played in the same league as me, they hated me until they met me. And so, you know, we're really good friends now. I try to keep in touch with those guys a lot. And guys like DeVore and Lauzon and Vladar, you know, we're all really close. And Tanishin as well. So I think, you know, playing with them is going to be a lot of fun through the next few years. And it's going to be something I'm looking forward to a lot.
Jesse, I talked to Don Sweeney today, and he shed some light on kind of the process of, you know, your journey, you know, as a player and a person. And one of the things he brought up that he really appreciated about the growth in your game is the discipline and the self-awareness, you know, just in terms of, you know, pointing out that you can't score goals from the penalty box, and that sometimes your best asset is having you on the ice where you can, you know, truly influence and impact a game. And then he had mentioned that they had talked to you about that they were very pleased to see the way you were picking your spots better this season. Is that something you take a lot of pride in terms of, you know, the success you've had this year, your second full season with Prince George?
Well, I mean, it's something I recognize, you know, when I did get drafted there, they liked that I kind of, you know, stir the pot on the ice and have that element to my game. I mean, when I was 16 and 17, I was completely overboard in the fact of just trying to get under everybody's skin. If they were 16 or 20, I didn't care. Just because, you know, that was the way that I liked to play. And when you're younger like that, you don't really know the line as well. But now that you know, I'm older in this league, you know, my coaches have helped me along the way, just finding that line. And, you know, for me, I feel like I don't actually take as many penalties because I was fighting a lot when I was getting, you know, 100-plus minutes. And for me, it's actually more I, you know, draw more penalties than I take. I think I was looking last year, and I think I actually drew more penalties than I took. And, you know, that's something I pride myself on is being disciplined in that sense where, sometimes, you know, you're going to not get the benefit of the doubt and take a penalty here or there. But finding that that line to, you know, draw a penalty, put your team on the attack and give your team that advantage, that's something I take a lot of pride in and something I want to continue for the rest of my career. If I can do that with Boston, I mean, that's a big asset, I think, and something I want to continue with.
Jesse, that's something we hear a lot about these days, is that line that players can't cross because it does have the effect of hurting the team at times, and keeping under that line and being able to compete that way. How do you draw that line internally? Say you take a cheap shot or a shot you feel is a little bit underhanded from the opposition. How do you internally say to yourself, no, I'm not going to retaliate. I'm not going to take a penalty in retaliation. I'm going to give my team that attack? Because I don't think a lot of fans realize just how difficult that can be on the ice.
Yeah, I think with like a player like me, I play with a lot of passion and a lot of emotion. So it's tough sometimes to keep those in check. Obviously, you know, you're going to go over that line and as learning points, just, you know, go over it and make a mistake. But I think going over those lines maybe earlier in my career helped me, you know, realize that, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. You know, you want to get in the ref's good books. That's something when I was 16, 17, kind of started a bit of a bad reputation in this league, but with the refs. But that's something I'm working on, just trying to, you know, get a good relationship with them back. And it's tough keeping the emotions in check, you know, when you play with a lot of passion, you're in the dirty areas, you know, you maybe take a stick to the face or, you know, someone, you know, horse collars you or whatever it is. But I think it's something that, you know, I've gotten a lot better at, and you know, continue to get better, and that's kind of what Boston, you know, wants me to do, and I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job of that. So it's a big part of my game, but, you know, something that I've had to learn over the past couple of years.
Jesse, I wanted to touch on Team Canada, if I could. There's a lot of people that think you should have at least had a look from Team Canada, including the three of us. And that's saying a lot since Reed and I are both OHL guys. Now, I've talked to players in the past who have been overlooked, not just by Team Canada, Team USA, who openly were upset and held a grudge. And then there are others that say, you know what, I'm going to do my speaking on the ice. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but since the WHL faced the Russians in the Super Series, your production has gone up 40%. And you're well over last year's production since then. So is it safe to say you fall into that latter category?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's something that you can't control. I've never been a Hockey Canada guy, really. So, you know, they have the guys picked out from a young age, and it is what it is. I'm aware that I'm not on that list. And, you know, getting, you know, snubbed from the Team WHL game, is, you know, since it was in Prince George, it was a little, you know, I had a little sour taste. But, you know, it is what it is. It's, they'll kind of lit a fire underneath me, and I guess if my production went up that much, I think, it might have been from that a little, just being a little upset, but also just, you know, putting it behind you and you know, just focusing on your team. I mean, obviously those personal, you know, accolades, you know, playing that game and playing for Team Canada, you know, those are huge honors, but I know that I'm not in that group that they've had picked for the longest time, so it is what it is, and I just, you know, plan on, you know, focusing on my team here in Prince George and winning a championship with them.
Jesse, to stay on a personal level, but something that I think a lot of fans might be interested in hearing, you mentioned earlier on you grew up a Bruins fan, and you did that out in Western Canada, and I know I've taken a lot of strange looks saying I'm a Bruins fan just south of Toronto, so I can only imagine out west. But was there a moment, a specific player, a specific play that made you a Bruins fan from a young age?
No, I've always been, you know, guys like watching the skill players and you know, like watching the fancy plays. But I've always been a fan, you know, the hard work and, you know, grinder type, pesky, agitating players. So I think what solidified, you know, me as a for sure Bruins fan is maybe, you know, when Brad Marchand, you know, that series against Vancouver when they won the cup. I mean, guy playing like that at such a young age, it was, you know, it's pretty cool to watch. And you know, at that kind of time, I thought, you know, maybe I could be a player like that who, you know, brings skill and kind of that pesky, agitating elements of the game. So I think that moment, that kind of solidified me as a Bruins fan, you know, for sure. I mean, as a young kid, you know, you kind of go back and forth, but that really solidified me as a diehard Bruins fan, you know, since then.
Now, Jesse, some people might not know, but you actually had the rare opportunity for a Saskatchewan kid to play a little Minnesota hockey and have that in your background. Can you kind of explain that and then maybe what that experience did to maybe help shape your experiences in the WHL, which is, you know, a higher level, but still, what did you maybe gain out of the Minnesota experience?
Well, there's just so much hockey in Minnesota. I'm sure you guys know about the amount of hockey there. There's just so much of it. And growing up in Moose, Saskatchewan, it's, you know, they take the ice out in the summer, so it's pretty hard to get ice. You know, you have to go to Calgary or Red Deer, or you have to make wicked drives to, you know, go to camps for the weekend. So my mom, she was going back to school, or she wanted to go back to school. school to be an LPN or to get her RN now. But that kind of played into us moving to Minnesota. So, you know, the amount of hockey that was there and my mom wanting to go back to school, that was the two big things of what made us move there. And, I mean, on the ice in Minnesota, I remember my first year there, me and my dad planned out to, I think, be on the ice or work out, you know, 360 out of the 365 days out of that year. And we ended up getting it just because we knew how far behind I was. Because I was good in Boosman, you know, obviously there's only 20 kids playing, so you are the best player, the best two or three. But then when you go there, there's thousands and thousands of players. And, you know, you kind of get your eyes open up, you know, how far behind I was. So we really made it a point to take advantage of all the available ice there and you know, get myself as prepared as possible for that upcoming year. And yeah, it was definitely, you know, a big game changer for me. I know I wouldn't be, you know, where I am now if we didn't move to Minnesota.
Awesome. Well, guys, do you have anything else that's getting close? You know, for the listeners that aren't aware, Jesse's doing a little pregame interview here. He's got to go out and continue to help Prince George march toward that WHL championship and perhaps a shot at the Memorial Cup. But do you guys have anything else for Jesse before we let him go?
Just want to say, Jesse, best of luck this season. We're really rooting for you. Want to see you eventually in the black and gold with the Boston Bruins. I think you're going to make a tremendous player for this team moving forward. And for this season, go get that WHL championship, get to the Memorial Cup, and hopefully we'll see you in Windsor.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Reed said. I'll be at the Memorial Cup in Windsor this year, Jesse, and definitely want to see you there. And I might even buy you a soda pop or something after a game.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot, guys, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, Jesse, again, congratulations on the new contract. And you are now officially in the system, and fans can give up their concerns. I was getting a lot of that on Twitter. Why haven't the Bruins signed to Jesse Gabriel? What's going on? And I had a little chuckle because I had kind of an inkling when you had told me something good had come up that it might be that. So we just kind of kept it under our hat, and we were very glad when the team announced it. So all the best to you, and again, thanks for coming on and joining the Three Amigos today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for having me again.
All right, cheers. All right, guys, so what do you think? Another successful guest segment on the Three Amigos, but I think Jesse Gabriel has a lot of fans really excited. So I can't think of two better guys to kind of break it down. I mean, we talked about it with him, but to kind of peel the onion back a little more and talk about what he brings to the table and why he's an exciting prospect because he was drafted in the fourth round. This is not a player, you know, that was a top 30 pick or a second round guy. I mean, the Bruins got him at 105. So, guys, take it away. Interested in your thoughts on what makes Jesse Gabriel such an exciting add to a very deep and talented system.
Well, I think, Kirk, if you go back in time now and you were to redraft, Jesse would go miles and miles higher, quite obviously. He's got all the talent in the world. He's got the speed. He's got the grit. He's got the shot. He's got everything that you could want out of a junior player, and especially for the fact that he is a Bruins fan. He wanted to be drafted by the Bruins. You can tell that really means something to him, that they actually did, and that he so many times in that interview mentioned how he's working on things that the Bruins wanted him to work on. That shows a tremendous commitment on his part. At such a young age, he gets it, and I think that's going to make a big difference in his career moving forward. There's no question why they're so high on him.
And myself, too. I just can't wait to see him and Brad Marchand go up against NHL opponents in a couple of years. But, you know, his response to the Team Canada snub for me says it all. He just wants to prove everybody wrong. And like Reed said, if you redo that draft, he probably goes much higher. But it just goes to show that the Bruins themselves, not just with Gabriel, but some of the other picks that they've made, are finding some players in those mid rounds, and he's just another example of why Bruins fans should be excited about what's coming through the system.
Yeah, you know, I'm eating a little crow here. I've been kind of saying, hey, pump the brakes on the Marchand comparisons, just because it's a pretty high bar. But again, I kind of poked at him a little and got him to come out and talk about it. But you know, Jesse's a bigger guy than Brad. He's probably not as fast a skater. You know, one of the things that makes Marchand just such a threat to score every time he's on the ice is that he not only has the blazing open ice speed, but he's a slashing, darting, extremely agile and elusive player. As you guys know, he can just turn people inside out with a series of shifty moves. So he has, you know, he's not just a quick player. He's a very fast player as well, and so he's got that edge. But when it comes to Jesse Gabriel, I think one of the things that he's able to do is when he does agitate and he gets under people's skin, if someone wants to call him on it, he has the size and the strength and the ability to fight to where he'll just drop the gloves and fight his own battles. And I think it's interesting that when he was younger, he had a lot more takers that wanted to fight him and pound on him. And then they realized sometimes some of them that they grabbed a tiger by the tail. If you look at some of these videos that are out there, his fight videos, and as he said this year, his penalty minutes are down because he doesn't have as many invitations to the dance. And I think that just speaks when you talk about players progressing and developing. Sometimes you talk about a player that creates space for himself. And I think that's a really good example of the evolution of Jesse Gabriel, where, you know, he was so abrasive and agitating as a younger guy, and so people wanted to knock him down a peg. And now that they've realized what he is and what he, you know, how tough he really is, he doesn't get as many people who are spoiling for a fight, and that has allowed him to then have the opportunity to play and score more goals for his team.
Right, because your reputation follows you, but once he gets into the NHL, it's a whole new ball game. So he's going to have to establish that reputation at that level again, I think.
I think one thing, too, that's going to make him an interesting player is that, like you were saying, Kirk, the comparison to Marchand is a little bit off because of the size difference and the way that Marchand plays with the quick cuts moving forward up the ice. But with Jesse, I don't know that there is really a perfect comparable that you could look at because of the way that he plays the game. His style of hockey, it is so much like Marchand in a lot of ways, but you add that size factor in, and I don't know that we've seen a guy that combines that kind of skill with the agitation with that kind of size, because you look at a Marchand, a Gallagher, go back in time to a Ken Linsman. They didn't have Jesse's size, and that, I think, is going to be something really neat to watch, because when he makes the impact in the NHL, he does have the ability to just kind of look at players and say, I don't think you really want a piece of me, and they're not going to take him, whereas Brad Marchand may get, and I say this as a smaller guy, may get picked on a bit because he's a little smaller in stature.
Yeah, no doubt, and I mean, I was really taken aback when I saw Jesse in Buffalo at the draft, just because he had put on some significant mass. Like, it was a body transformation that was noticeable from the year before when he'd been drafted. And in the back of my mind, I said, this is going to be interesting. Is this going to impact and affect him at all, just in terms of his foot speed? And no, the answer is no, it hasn't. So he gained the right weight. And he's a monster. For fans that maybe don't know this, you can go on YouTube and you can look at him at age 15, deadlifting 450 pounds. And that was at age 15. And if you just look at the way he does it on the video, I mean, it's freakish, right? So he's got this, you know, he's kind of built like a bowling ball. He's not the tallest guy, but he's tall enough. But just he's had a tremendous amount of core strength and athletic ability. And that's what allows him to, you know, to grab onto guys, grapple, ragdoll opponents. I mean, a lot of the fighting really is in the core and the balance. And, I mean, you can be the strongest guy and you can be tough and quick with your fists. But if you can't dig your edges into the ice and stay strong on your skates in a fight, you're not going to be a very good fighter. And I think that's when you watch, you know, Gabriel fight, that's one of the things he does pretty well. I mean, he's strong on his skates and he gets a hold of guys. And I think sometimes that's when I say they grab a tiger by the tail, that's what I mean. They don't realize how strong he really is until he's got, you know, he's clamped down with one hand and has got them in a vise and he's pistoning them with the other. I can't imagine that's a very comfortable, enjoyable feeling. So it's understandable why Bruins fans are excited about him. And you tip the hat to the Bruins organization for not waiting, but going out and getting him signed and also sending a message to him that his work is noticed and rewarding him for that by giving him that security. So we don't have to hear for the next 4 or 5 months, hey, you know, when are they going to sign Gabriel? Deadline's coming up. I mean, it's done, and we can move on.
Yeah, and, you know, it's good to have him in the fold. It's just when you look at not only Jesse Gabriel, but the rest of the prospects, you've got to feel good about where this team is going. I just thought of it now, but I wish I had asked him. I know Jamie Langenbrunner has been out there a couple of times to see him, so I'm wondering what kind of influence he's had over Jesse over the last couple of months.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Jamie, and yeah, he shed some light on it. He said he was very impressed by the work that Jesse put in. The words that Jamie used to me on the phone about him was that everything they told him that he's taken to heart, and you know, they sense there's a tremendous desire on his part. The first part he talked about being drafted, that's a small step in the grand scheme of things, but to be drafted by the one team he really was hoping and really hoped and believed would happen did. And now the next part is the work he's got to put in to get there and actually make that team. And, you know, we have Matty Grizzlick called up tonight. Looks like he's going to play. At least he was in the line combos at practice. I did talk to Don Sweeney, and he said that the decision as to whether Grizzlick will play tonight or not play is going to be left up to the coaches. But again, as I'm talking about Gabriel and Langenbrunner talking about rewarding him for the work he's put in, you get the same kind of thing with a Matt Grizzlick, who, you know, he was behind the power curve last spring because he was injured, and when he signed, he couldn't go to Providence and get that first taste. And players like Jesse Gabriel went to Providence. They talked about him going in without a contract, but that he wanted to play. He expressed the desire to get that opportunity to go to the AHL, and so he did so at personal risk to himself if something had happened and he'd gotten injured, not having that top cover of an NHL deal. And it was the same thing with Grizzlick. He couldn't go to Providence, so they said Grizzlick was a little behind the power curve, but in the first month or so of the season, you could see it, but that he's really come on, and they're so impressed with his poise and his play down in Providence and just the work he was putting in to get better and better, and so that's why he's up with the team.
Now, is Jesse a 96 or
he's a 97. He's a 97, so if he could not play full-time in Providence. So when his season ended last year in the WHL playoffs, he was then able to go and play in Providence, and he signed an amateur tryout to cover those games. But it all, you know, I mean, you know the nuts and bolts and the dollars and cents, Dom, better than anyone. You know, if something happens to him and he's not on a guaranteed, you know, contract, that's risky business, both for him and for the team.
Yeah, he took a big risk in that personally, definitely. Yeah.
But Sweeney said it was really him. I mean, he was the driving force. He came to the team and said, hey, I want to do this. I think this will help me and make me a better player and help the organization if I get this experience. And so there you go. I mean, the fans don't see this stuff. It doesn't make it typically into articles and press releases unless someone shares it. And that was kind of where Don Sweeney was going as we were talking about Jesse, was his commitment to getting better, his recognition of the things that were holding him back a bit. And Jamie Langenbrunner just reinforced that with his own observations. And this is a player I think the organization's pretty excited about. And let's face it, guys. I mean, Reed, you talked about it, and Dom as well. I think the mid-rounders, maybe it was you, Dom. I think it was you, Dom. Come to think of it. But the mid-rounders that they're hitting on, guys like Anders Bjork, you know, Jesse Gabriel. I mean, that's back-to-back drafts where they nail a fourth and a fifth rounder. You know, just that's, you know, pretty significant. And then going even in 2014 with Danton Heinen.
Well, it speaks to this organization now, guys, too, in that you look at how much work they've done on the scouting side, and they've rebuilt that scouting group over the course of years, and they've added so many top-end smart hockey guys to the front office that I think a lot of people, and I said this to you guys earlier when we were planning for the show, that a lot of people talked about maybe Don Sweeney didn't have the quote-unquote respect of other general managers around the league. Well, I bet you he sure does now. When you take a look at the pipeline he's built in Boston, there's got to be a lot of people looking at this Bruins team going, they're going to get young, fast, skilled really quickly.
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing that the people, that management types and scouts around the league are not going to deny, and that is the presence and the investment in time and resources that the Boston Bruins have placed in the amateur scouting. I told you guys last year at the under-18s, they had six members of the organization out scouting that tournament because they recognized, you know, that it was very important. And yes, you know, Charlie McAvoy wasn't the guy they took, but they were certainly looking at guys like Dante Fabro, and then they ended up drafting Ryan Lindgren, their second choice, or their third choice, and then, of course, Trent Frederick was at that tournament. So, you know, the investment in resources and energy and time to go and plumb the depths of the various leagues out there to find talent is being made, and I don't think any team is going to dispute that, but it's an unforgiving business. So, you know, you can go out all you want. You can go to all the tournaments you want. If you don't draft the right guys, then, you know, it's a results-oriented business. But I think, Dom, you would certainly agree and offer up that at least right now, going back to 2014, the last three drafts appear to be on par to be some of the most productive in team history, at least going back to 2006, which was the Kessel, Lucic, Marchand draft.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, I love the prospects. And, you know, the three of us have touched on this numerous times. There's too many prospects. At some point, a decision is going to have to be made on some of these guys. And I think that's where we'll see where Donnie Sweeney's bread and butter is when it comes to making decisions, because let's face it, they're not going to be able to fit all these guys in. So, you know, they've done well. They've done very well. And now we're going to have to see if they make the right choices on who to keep. And just to touch on something Reed said, the revamping of the scouting department. I know you and I have called this in the past the Winnipeg model, Kirk, where there's a lot of crossover in scouting, like the Winnipeg Jets do. But it's quality over quantity. They you know, I remember the Leafs a couple of years ago had 19 amateur scouts, but what was it getting them? And, you know, they had people stuck in their own areas, and there was a lot of arguing, a lot of debating, and their drafting wasn't very well. So, as Reed says, it's quality and not quantity, getting the right people there. It'll be interesting to see what happens now with Keith Gretzky gone, but I think it was a group thing. It wasn't Keith Gretzky himself. I think, you know, you add in the Dean Malcock and the others, and you've got some quality people there.
Ryan Nato, Scott Fitzgerald,
yeah, all
the area guys. You're right. You know, and they do. They get a lot of guys looking at a lot of different players so that they can expand the discussions and have more people involved. And I know they hired Ryan Hardy to replace Sully this year. And yeah, I think he was the director of player development for the U.S. national team the last couple of years. So I think you're going to continue to see a lot of them, you know, looking at these, you know, U.S., maybe, you know, USHL players that are headed for college, Canadian kids that are headed for college, because you're right. I mean, you talked about it, Dom, too many prospects. So, you know, for those folks that, that love Major Junior, the signs I'm getting is that they're just going to build standoff by drafting more of these college bound guys. Cause it's a state, it's a pragmatic situation of 2 years of rights and then having to sign versus 4 years. And, so I think that if you read the tea leaves, it looks like there will be, probably more, you know, similar to what they've been doing of late, where they're drafting guys that are, they're going to be able to retain their rights and kind of be able to watch them develop more, but we'll see. I think ultimately they, you know, they showed in 2015, they'll take the best players regardless of where, you know, who the best players are in their mind, regardless of what league they're in. But it's just, it's interesting to me if you look at who they've added to the staff, they seem to be primed to continue to mine that, that vein of gold there that they've been hitting pretty successfully. Now let's shift gears, guys, and let's talk about World Junior Championship. We've got... big cuts coming up with Canada. We've got two Bruins prospects there. Talk about Sinishin and Lauzon and what you guys think. What are we going to find out here when the final cuts are made and they unveil that roster? What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of both. I think Lauzon has probably a slighter... better chance of making it than Sinishin.
Is it because he was there last year? Was that, you know, is that
yeah, I, that and they only have one returning D on the roster this year. So his experience from last year, I think he was one of the last cuts last year.
For
Team Canada, but. You know, they really didn't invite a lot of defensemen to camp. Victor Mete was a surprise to me getting invited. I mean, I think I talked to you guys. I was shocked that he was invited and was one of the first cuts. So I think they're down to having two defensemen, two forwards, and a goalie left to cut. And you know, there's rumors that that might happen after tonight's exhibition game with the Czechs, but Bob McKenzie alluded to it earlier today that, you know, they actually might just wait and try and make a push to NHL teams to see if they'd release a guy like Chychrun, you know, to go play. So I think Sinishin will be in a little tougher than Lauzon to make the roster, but you know, he stands a good chance, and I'm rooting for it. He looked good the other night. I watched the game. For those in Canada, you can watch it streamed on TSN. So I don't know. To me, Team Canada looks good. Their goaltending looks good. They're a little weak on the left side, which makes me even more upset that Jesse Gabriel wasn't invited. But
yep,
you know, that's their weak spot, is their left side. I think they're locked up down the center. Blake Spears, who happens to be Zach Sinishin's teammate in Sault Ste. Marie, has played his first game since October in the exhibition game yesterday. Looked good. And, you know, he ain't cracking center, so he's either going to play the left side or the right side. So he's in direct competition with Sinishin there if their plan is to use him on the right side. And he's a right shooter, so, you know, we'll see what happens tonight. But I don't think that they're going to make the final cuts today.
I think they've got to find a way to keep Sinishin on the team, because one thing that we've seen in the World Juniors is that speed certainly kills, and that's one thing that Sinishin absolutely has in spades. And he's the kind of guy that can create his own offense. He can score a big goal for you. I think if you put him with the right line mates in this group, you could have a very, very productive line with him on it, and that could be a real matchup nightmare when you take a look at what the lines would break down as for Team Canada. I agree with Dom. I think Lauzon, I think he's got to be on the team at this point. The returning defenseman situation, the fact that he was there last year, his skill set, it translates so well to a tournament like this. I would be very surprised personally to see either one of them cut from Team Canada, but as we all know, Hockey Canada has done some very, very strange things, and I think not inviting Jesse Gabriel would be another one of those. So, you know, anything's possible, but I think they'd be crazy to cut either one of them.
But they're also going a different route this year, Reed. They don't have the so-called checking line that they like to bring in the past. They're going with speed and they're going with skill. So, you know, that might be an advantage to Sinishin.
It's got to be. It's got to be. You know?
Yeah. Well, a couple things, notes that from Don Sweeney and just asking him about both players today. The first thing he said about Lauzon was that, you know, he's just absolutely miserable to play against, and that he's, you know, he's growing into his body and filling out a lot more, and he's going to get bigger and stronger. Now, what the Bruins don't know is, you know, he's put up a decent amount of points in the Quebec League. They don't know how that will translate at the pro level, but that he's just such a good, well-rounded player. He does everything well, from the skating. He's got a good shot. They said, you know, he's got to get better at the, you know, at the first pass. Maybe in the puck moving aspects of his game could be a little crisper, the transitions, but that he just is a tremendous character leader type. You know, he wears the C in Rouyn Noranda. And then the anecdote he shared that was so impressive was the neck injury that Lauzon suffered last spring in the playoffs, and that he was just bound and determined to come back for the Memorial Cup. And on the very first shifts, Don Sweeney was talking about watching the game, and he just said he just stepped into a player and just planted him. He said that was just an indicator of, you know, that some kids might have been tentative or kind of hesitant, you know, after such a long layoff and suffering such a scary injury. But he, it was like he didn't miss anything more than a shift. And so very pleased. And then, of course, on Sinishin's side, Don Sweeney talked about just the sheer explosiveness and how, you know, defenders are just not sure how to play him sometimes, because he's, even though everyone knows what he's going to do, game in and game out, he said that it seems like defenders are still caught flat-footed and unaware. Like, they seem to be surprised at just the sheer speed that he's able to generate in the open ice, and the way, you know, he's almost like the Roadrunner, you know, meep, meep, you know, as he goes by. And, you know, the defenseman's like waving, come back. And he's off to the races. But it said that, you know, it's the details in his game have got to improve, you know, just rounding out, doing the little things. They said they're getting better. He's getting the coaching, that it's not just about pumping up the goal totals. It's about, you know, more, you know, being heavier on the puck, harder on the puck, and he's getting there and he's coming along. So overall, Don Sweeney was pretty encouraged by what he's seen from both players, and obviously his fingers are crossed that they're going to make the cut.
And Kirk, one thing that you said that rings so true on Sinishin is the acceleration and the speed, and it's such short burst acceleration, and that the Roadrunner comparison is perfectly apt. How you'd see the Roadrunner in the cartoon just start his feet and he was gone.
Yeah.
If you watch Sinishin through the neutral zone, he picks up the puck and he can almost be at a standstill, and then bang, he sees an opening and the defender's in the dust going, what in the world just happened?
Yeah.
And that is so exciting about his game, and you can't take your eyes off him when he has the puck on his stick, because you just never know when he's going to hit the gas and take somebody on one-on-one and just flat out beat them.
And I've seen him do it to a guy like Jacob Chychrun, so it's not like, yep, these are no-name, you know, defenders that don't have, you know, like he's matched up against guys that can't you know, our lower end guys. I mean, he's pretty consistent against anybody.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. He's done it against some of the best. But the thing about Sinishin, though, is everybody looks for that speed and that burst and beat the defender outside. But, I mean, we all saw the highlights of his four-goal game last week. He can score in multiple ways. It isn't always down the wing, beat the defender, cut to the net. He's just got that ability to put the puck in the net in so many different ways. It isn't always about that speed burst.
Yeah, I'm really wishing I had soundproofed my office. For those listeners that picked up on the screeching, that was my 10-year-old who always seems to decide in the middle of Dad's podcast that she's going to yell from downstairs instead of walking up the stairs and telling her mother what, you know, she wants to say. So apologies if you heard a little loud banshee-like wailing in the background. That was Kendall Ludicky. So there you go. Anyway, well, please continue.
we're not a multi-million dollar podcast here.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me that whenever I hit record, that's the day when she decides to yell the loudest. But I've got the dog barking in the backyard, so it's interesting, guys. High adventure. We're a low-budget operation, but we're proud of it because really when it comes down to it, we spend very little, and I think you know, our content is tough to beat. I'm intrigued by a couple of prospects that I suspect you'll have you'll have an opinion on because of your distinct interest in European hockey. So I wanted to give you the floor to kind of talk about what you know. Peter Cehlárik was in the Swedish Hockey League here last couple of years with Luleå, now over in Providence. So you had a chance to see him a bit when he was playing in Sweden, and now he's doing quite well statistically with Providence. And then, of course, Emil Johansson, defenseman with Djurgården, who was a seventh-round pick in 2014. Can you kind of just talk a little about what you think about those two players and what kind of opportunity you would like to see them get in the Bruins organization?
Absolutely. Cehlárik is a player that I've really liked for some time because I think he's got such a multifaceted game. He's a very smart player. And when I watched him play with Luleå, you could see that the offensive game had the potential to catch up to the other things that he did on the ice. And for a guy who was playing on the big ice in Europe, he was somebody who liked to get into confined spaces, not because he was throwing a heavy hit or because he was just knocking somebody straight off the puck, but he's very quick, very nifty with his stick, especially in through corners, in through tight spaces, even into the front of the net. He can get a quick stick lift off and just suddenly take possession of the puck before the defender really knows what exactly has just happened. And that is something I think goes really unnoticed in his game quite a lot. I like his defensive positioning. He's a pretty good skater. I think that especially on smaller ice, it won't stand out as much as it did kind of in the European leagues, where you sort of saw him at times. He would disappear a little bit from the play, but he always found a way to reappear in some sort of major area, either setting a play, potting a goal, or a very nice back check. I think he's got a chance to be a good, solid middle six to bottom line player for the Boston Bruins. I think he could fit well on any of those lines. He's got the vision that he could play in a little bit more of a scoring role. He's got the work ethic and the defensive responsibility that he can play in a checking role. He can blend it very well. So that's where I would like to see him. Emil Johansson is a player that he was a project pick, a little bit undersized, but the talent was there and you could see it from the beginning. He gets the puck on his stick. He can explode up the ice. Very quick skater, very good burst, a lot of fun to watch, honestly. The defensive game was something where you wondered, okay, is he going to get out-muscled? He's grown a bit, which has helped him. He's put on some weight, some size, which, again, will help his transition, especially if he's planning to make the jump into North American hockey. And I think he's the kind of guy who's very cerebral in his game. He's very smart, sees the ice very well. How that will translate when he goes from big ice to smaller ice is yet to be seen on a large scale, and whether that vision is going to keep up, because things happen faster when you get to the NHL level, obviously. And that will be the key for him, is adjusting to that. But I really do like the trajectory that both of these guys are on, I think Johansson is probably still a bit away. He's still somebody that I would think of as a project player. I don't think he can come out of Sweden and step right into the NHL. I think he would need some time to adjust, especially playing defense, to adjust to North American hockey. But both of them have opportunity, and both of them could be interesting trade chips down the line as well. If Dom said, eventually somebody's got to be moved. If the Bruins don't see them in plans, I could easily see them being very attractive to somebody else.
Yeah. Bad news on Johansson, by the way. I was told today that he is injured. Length of time on shelf, TBD, but upper body injury. So we hope wish him a speedy recovery. But the quote I got is, just as he was starting to feel it and really gain confidence and round into form there, he got dinged up. So we'll have to kind of see what happens there. Good stuff, Reed. Dom, over to you. Are there a couple of prospects that you're, you know, we've talked about Sinishin. I know obviously he's OHL guy, so near and dear to your heart. But is there anyone else that you're particularly intrigued by and really looking forward to seeing what comes next in their development from your perspective?
Yeah, a name you mentioned earlier, and hopefully this will stop some of the worrying that's going out there among Bruin fans on Twitter and other places, is Anders Bjork. I keep hearing or reading that you know, he's going to pull the Jimmy Vesey and you know, the Bruins got to sign him today or they're going to lose him and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, they've got, what, a year and 8 months to sign him. I believe it's August 15th, 2018 they have.
Yeah,
until right. Kirk.
Yep.
This guy is just a phenomenal player. Another one of those players they found in the middle round of the drafts. I just can't wait to see what he does. Now, with any player that you draft, there's always the possibility that you could lose the player. It doesn't matter whether he comes from the NCAA or whether he comes from the CHL or from Europe. The risk is always there.
Yeah.
But there has been absolutely no sign from the player or the team that there isn't going to be an attempt to get him under contract. So, you know, the Bruins have a player here. You know, I've watched some video of him this year, and literally the guy could probably step into the NHL right now. And maybe not be a top six or a top nine right off the bat, but he will be someday. And it wouldn't surprise me in the least that if his season ends early enough that the Bruins try and sign him in the spring, have him play a game or two and burn off a year of his entry-level contract, much like the Jets did with Tanev last year, although he was a free agent.
Yeah, he was older, so yeah.
Yeah, but a different situation, but mm-hmm. kind of the same.
Yep.
You know,
yeah, I think you're 100% right, Dom. I think that's going to be the new boutique thing that agents, or shall we say family advisors, employ. If you want to sign these guys and get them out, you're going to have to give up something. And unlike Torrey Krug, who, you know, was a undrafted free agent, I mean, you'll own their draft rights, but if you want to get them out, you're probably going to have to do something like that. Give them a guaranteed game or two, let them burn the ELC, you know, something like that. And then that will, and you know, why wouldn't you do that? That's what these people get paid to do, right?
And the Bruins are in good financial position to do something like that, Kirk. It's,
right.
It's you know, financially they're okay. So it's no big deal, but it just bothers me when I, you know, there's been a handful of players over the last several years that have done what Jimmy Vesey did. And to his credit, he used, I don't want to call it a loophole because it's there.
That's
in the
not,
CPA.
Not
it's
a
not a loophole. He's entitled to that, but it's very rare that a player uses that part of the CBA to his advantage. And as you said, family advisors have found a way to get their players ahead of the game. And the Bruins are in an absolute perfect position with him. I just can't wait to see him in the NHL. I mean, from what I've seen a video of him, I love the kid. And I mean, he's well ahead of what Jimmy Vesey, well, I shouldn't say well ahead. He's ahead of Jimmy Vesey's pace in terms of scoring this year, if I'm not mistaken.
That's close. I mean, you know, it's yeah. And I mean, he's yeah. You might be right. Yeah.
I just want to put that talk to rest, because I mean, there's 18 months left. Like, come on, people. Let's not worry about that right now.
Yeah. No. I think if the Bruins make an attempt to sign him this spring, and for whatever reason it doesn't get done, you're going to hear the talk, and then you know, at that point, you kind of have to take a step back and reassess it. But you're right, you know. I'll use this quote here. You'll see it in print, too, in my prospect piece for New England Hockey Journal. But, you know, when it comes to Anders Bjork, I just think fans need to, you know, just relax and enjoy the fireworks show while it lasts right now. And, you know, because they're not going to sign him tomorrow. The soonest we'll even know anything is when the Fighting Irish play their last game. And whether that's, you know, preliminary round of the Hockey East, you know, playoff tournament, or it's, you know, the very last game of the Frozen Four tournament, we don't know. That we'll have to just let the season play out or anywhere in between. That's when the situation will ultimately be able to be addressed. So, you know, what amazes me, guys, is it's complicated. The different rules for the different players and the different leagues that they're in. But there are just so many people. It seems like we talk about this constantly. And I don't know if people are just not paying attention or they're so used to being spoon-fed that whatever, you know, when we tell them something or we explain something, they just purge that information. So they're like, you know, asking the same. You know, it's like the old Tom Hanks episode on our skit on Saturday Night Live, Mr. Short-Term Memory. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yes.
Where, you know, he's forgetting what he asked just like 5 seconds before. You know, and I just have to be patient, I guess, and just do my best to answer the fans. But there just seem to be a lot of folks that I've kind of gotten used to. They ask the same questions over and over, and they don't understand. And I would just encourage people to, you know, go out and research, you know, do your best to try to answer the question for yourself. Because as the X-Files, as Fox Mulder used to say, the truth is out there. Rather than just asking a question and making someone else do the work or put in the effort to verify the answer or answer your question, just do the research. You're online, you're on the internet. And I know people are going to say, well, that's what I have you for. But, you know, at sometimes, you know, we don't always have great days, and when you're asking these questions, you might be catching us at a tough moment. So, I don't understand why it's so hard for people to grasp that, you know, the difference between Anders Bjork and his impending free agency, which is quite a ways off, and why that wouldn't be, you know, a Jimmy Vesey situation. Whereas, you know, if people just took, you know, a 30 seconds to research it, they would see, you know, very clearly, he cannot be a free agent for another 18 or so months. And so it's not a Vesey situation as we're sitting here in December, you know, worrying about a deadline that could be coming up, you know, this August. It's 2 Augusts from now. So I'm with you, man. I hope that people listening to this podcast understand the spirit it's intended. We're human, you know, and sometimes I see online, people like have this sense of entitlement. They think that, hey, if I ask a question, you know, you're not allowed to be, you know, to comment on my question. I'm just asking a question. Well, no, I mean, you know, I think people can meet you halfway and at least try to put forth an effort to research the answer. And if they honestly don't know how to find it or they can't find it, that's one thing. But I think some people have just gotten so used to just being spoon-fed information. And, you know, for once, it would be nice for folks to just kind of take a breath, take a step back, and do some independent, you know, exercise some independent thought. But that's my rant. I'm off my soapbox. We've gone over an hour. Guys, what do you think? Anything we didn't hit before we wrap this up?
Well, I'm going to ask you guys a question that has to do with the Bruins of today as opposed to the Bruins of tomorrow. And we know as of today, they're sitting in second place within the division. And everybody thought that the defense was going to be a problem for this team, and it turns out to be the offense. But I'm going to bring it a step further and going to ask you guys why. And that is this. They are tied for second worst in the conference in terms of point percentage on home ice. They are tied for third worst points percentage in the league on home ice. What is the problem with the TD Garden?
Crickets. Reed, you want to try to tackle that one?
Wow. It's interesting because it's a question that I've been... That is a really good question. Oh, my goodness. I'm not really sure that there's an answer that we can grasp easily. When you look at this team, the way the defense is played, Brandon Carlo has completely changed the way this team has got to be looking at what it needs to acquire to more solidify it. But there's no reason that this group should not be making the TD Garden a miserable place to play. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be scoring more goals. You look at that lineup, David Backes, in his big moments so far with the Bruins, has been a beast. And maybe transitioning to the right wing a little bit has thrown him just slightly off at times. David Krejci coming back from surgery, I don't think, and I think Jack Edwards or Brick said this the other night, that Krejci said he was only at about 85%, and we're starting to see that really come around. But I don't understand entirely what the problem offensively with this group is. You should be able to think that this team would be better in terms of goal scoring than they were a year ago. And when you look at the pieces alone, when you get to a point in late January and Frank Vetrano's back and Matt Bolesky's back, and yeah, you're going to have to make some tough decisions in terms of who stays up and who goes down and who's in and who's out. But I just have this total belief that it's going to turn in the right direction, especially on home ice for this offense, just generally because there's too much talent for it not to happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, until I looked at the schedule, you know, throw out the last two losses at home against Toronto and Colorado. These are the goaltenders they've been going up against at home in the losses that they've suffered. Henrik Lundqvist, Jake Allen, Chad Johnson, Devin Dubnyk, Carey Price. Those are some pretty good goaltenders. So I was going to say, you know, maybe the teams had something to do with just the struggle, you know, the early season schedule. So their first home game on October 20th was against New Jersey. You know, they won that one. That was Corey Schneider. That was the late heroics there, scoring late. Or maybe that was a shootout victory. I don't really recall. But they were only able to get, you know, two goals scored, and it's just the lack of production has been killing them, because you've got two goals that they scored in a win, and then the next game they scored two goals and lost. And then the home game after that, no goals against Devin Dubnyk. That was when he was in the middle of his shutout streak. I think he had three consecutive shutouts. And then, you know, you're facing Henrik Lundqvist. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But if you look at the Bruins, the most goals they've scored at home in any one game is 5. And that was against the Columbus Blue Jackets on November 10th. You know, they've had a couple four-goal games, you know, sprinkled in there. But I think, you know, I mean, when you name off those goalies that I named, and again, throw out the disappointing losses to Colorado and Toronto aside, but, you know, Frederik Andersen, historically, going back to his days with the Ducks, has had Boston's number.
Right.
Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know.
But this has been a problem for a couple of years now, though, Kirk, home ice. And, I mean, I did the quick math. And if they had the same points percentage at home as they do on the road, they'd be right there with Montreal.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's hard to explain. Is it, home is not sweet home. What gives teams home ice advantage? You know, what are the factors that allow teams to play better at home? I mean, some would tell you it has to do with familiarity of the building. I mean, knowing where the sweet spots are, where you can drive the puck and get certain bounces, things like that. You know, we certainly knew for years the Bruins benefited from the smaller Boston Garden ice surface, and players like Cam Neely thrived there because he could make a living in that smaller space and impose his will physically. I've always felt that ever since the TD Garden, the Fleet Center, all that opened up, and that just kind of really changed everything. It seems like it was a cavernous, what I loved about the Boston Garden when I was a kid growing up was the close confines and how loud and rocking that place would get. Which is not to say TD Garden doesn't get that way, but when I went to my first couple games at the Fleet Center in 95, 96, when it opened up, I thought to myself, this isn't the same. You know, it's kind of open and more cavernous, and it's not, you know, you don't have that same feeling of being right up on top of the players. And when you hear all the old funny stories about the gallery gods that you hear people talking about, where, you know, guys are chirping the players, and that was a fixture of that smaller, you know, TD or Boston Garden ice surface, and you just don't hear the same kind of stuff. I'm sure the hecklers are heard, but you don't get that, you know, you don't get that heckle that like resonates throughout the building like you could do in the old Garden days. So I don't know, it's a good, I don't have an answer. I don't know.
Well, you bring a good point, because I'll bring up a quick thing about it, is if you look at all the playoff teams, the Edmonton Oilers, who we all know are in a new arena this season, are the only other playoff team that has a 500 or lower points percentage at home. So, yeah, you bring up a good point there.
I think, too, you got to, as much as, yeah, there is an obvious difference with TD Garden and Boston Garden. And I know you're not saying anything negative, really, about TD Garden, Kirk, but it did have, that building had a lot to live up to. Because the Boston Garden is one of the most iconic venues, not just in hockey, but in sports. Yeah. When you look at the names that played there and the events that happened there, and the lights going out in overtime and Bobby Orr flying through the air and the whole thing, that building has a lot to live up to. And I do think that, now granted, I only saw it on television. I wish I had been there. But some of those playoff games in 2011, boy, oh boy, some of the sounds that you could even get coming through the TV and the way that crowd looked, it's definitely got the potential to live up to some of it, but it definitely is different, and there's got to be a way for the Bruins to capitalize better on home ice. It's just a matter of what in the world do you have to do? And in fact, guys, we're actually going through the same thing right now in Hamilton, because the Bulldogs have had the same problem on home ice. They were wretched in their recent 7-game homestand. They only won one game. So if we can figure out the problem for one team, maybe we can extrapolate it to the other team, because both my teams could use a little help.
Yeah, both wear black and gold.
Right, yeah. That's right. Both wear black and gold.
So I maybe, and again, this is just a hypothesis. It isn't tested in any way, shape, or form. It's an educated guess, perhaps. But we know that Boston fans tend to be pretty fickle. And when they love you, man, they love you. And you couldn't ask for better support and just a better situation. But when they don't love you or they don't believe in you, then I think that can be problematic just in terms of the level of enthusiasm. And I want to share with you a story from 1987. And I remember being, every year religiously, I would pick up the Sports Illustrated, Sporting News, Sport Magazine, all those magazines that would come out with their annual NHL preview. And I would read those, snap those up, you know, first week of September, or, you know, late August when they would come out. And I remember that year, because it's significant. Because in you guys will recall this is 1987-88 season, Bruins went to the Stanley Cup Final for the first time since 78.
I was born during one of the games of the Stanley Cup Final.
So you don't remember, Reed, but I'm sure you studied up on it, right?
I did, absolutely.
So, but for Dom and I, that season was unexpected. No one was, the Bruins were not a powerhouse going into the 87-88 season. The team that was kind of accepted to be coming out of the Adams division that year was the Montreal Canadiens, as they had done the year before, and then they'd won the Stanley Cup the year before that. And what I remember was a quote in that Boston Bruins preview article from none other than Chris Nyland. And he was talking about, and it was in the Boston Bruins section, and he was quoted as saying something along the lines of, "There's no energy in the garden," because that's how Nyland would have said. I can almost hear him, giving that quote to whoever wrote the story. "There's no energy in the garden. I grew up," and he's talking about when he grew up and the Bob Uhr days and how rocking it was. And he was saying that in the mid-80s, you were talking 85, 86, 84, 85, 86, which, oh, by the way, coincided with three straight years that the Montreal Canadiens swept the Bruins out of the playoffs in the first round. He said there was no energy. And that quote stuck with me because at first I was like, "Hey, what are you talking about, Knuckles? You don't know what, and I had a defensive reaction. I was in high school and my dander was up. And, but then I thought about it and I was like, we haven't had a lot to cheer about lately. But when we went on that run, or when the Bruins went on that run that year, it was magical, and the place was rocking. And I couldn't recall a more fired up Boston Garden in my lifetime. I was too young to remember, the glory days of when they were winning Stanley Cups, although I was alive for those days. And my parents tell me I enjoyed them, quite well. But I don't have any memory. But I think maybe that's it. Maybe, when the fans don't think that there's much to get excited about, it's hard to get that overall energy going. And it's almost like a confirmation bias, guys, where, they go in there and if the team isn't playing all that well, the fans go, "See, I told you, they just don't have it." And then you don't have that energy. I don't know. I'm trying to throw some stuff out there. But I just think that, back in 2011, that team performed well. Timmy Thomas, won the Vezina Trophy that year. They had a lot to be excited about. They were a favored team going into that playoff series, that playoff season. And then they just kind of rode that wave. Beating Montreal was huge after falling behind 2-0. And then they swept Philly. And that set up just the amazing energy of the Tampa Bay and the Vancouver series in Boston. And I just have to think that when fans believe that there is something to be excited about, man, they're awesome. But if they don't, Bostonians, it's hard to fake it, man. If they're not feeling it, they're going to let you know. So that's my hypothesis, for what it's worth, better or worse, pick it apart. But that Nyland quote popped into my head because he said that. Back when he was a player, still with the Montreal Canadiens, and he was trying to explain how the Boston-Montreal rivalry had diminished in recent years, and he was ascribing it to an apathy, in the Boston fan base. The Bruins-Habs rivalry wasn't as intense as it had been because the fans didn't care. Well, they certainly proved him wrong that year, and that, about 6-7 months later, Mr. Nyland was home playing golf for the first time since World War II, at the hands of a Bruins team, defeating the Canadiens, and there were a whole lot of fired up people. So there it is.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Kirk, but I think part of that mid-80s malaise, perhaps, in the Boston Garden could be described in the fact that when they went out to try to improve the team in those years and make a run, did they not bring in Butch Goring near the end of his career? And Charlie Simmer, who I believe still had pretty good statistics with the Bruins, but Simmer at the end of his career. And then we saw the same thing in the mid-90s when they tried to bring in Joe Mullen and Kevin Stevens right at the end of their runs.
Yes. Yeah, that was kind of a Harry Sinden staple. He would kind of bring in these guys that, you know, had been successful. I remember Billy Derlego was one. Oh, my God. Remember, Dom? Billy Derlego.
Oh, I love Morris. I actually love Billy Derlego.
Oh, yeah, when he was with the Leafs, man.
Yeah, I loved him in Toronto.
When he was with the Leafs, but geez, the Billy Derlego that came to the Bruins for Tom Fergus. Oh, my gosh.
I wanted to stab
myself in the eye with a sharp pencil.
Fergus went on to have a couple of good seasons with the Leafs after that.
Yes, he most certainly did, and usually at Boston's expense, I would add.
Yes,
he seemed
definitely.
To relish sticking it to his old team. Morris Lukowich, I mean, Brent Ashton, you know, the list goes on and on. I mean, guys that were really, you know, good players when they were wearing and productive players when they were wearing other colors, and then they would come to Boston. That's a good point, Reed. I think the, you know, two players that really helped infuse life and excitement into those Bruins teams. Well, let's say three. Certainly that year were Cam Neely, because he had come in 86-87 the year before and had fired everyone up and 36 goals. But then he scored 42. That second year he was in Boston was the true, okay, this guy's for real. He has arrived, and he was really what got people fired up about Cam. Was the way he would produce against Montreal. He had a couple hat tricks against the Canadiens that season, if I'm not mistaken. And nothing will get a Boston fan behind you quicker than being a Habs killer. And I think in that era, Cam Neely was the original Habs killer because he just had Patrick Waugh's number.
Did he ever. Did he ever.
So, and then the second guy, of course, is Ray Bourque, hit his prime and, you know, played. You know, that was when he began his string of Norris trophies, was right around that time. Won his first one in 87, won another one in 88, you know, again in 90, 91, and then 94. I believe he won five, if I'm not mistaken. But
yeah, he did, and he was statistically, if you go by some of the stats they use today to decide the Norris Trophy, he was statistically robbed of probably four or five other ones where you could have said he was most certainly the best defenseman in the league, and it just kind of grinds my gears that a lot of people don't recognize him as the second greatest of all time, just below the man in Bobby Orr, because, well, he had five Norrises, and so-and-so had six, and it's, yeah, well, okay, but they didn't just do it on who had the most points as a defenseman in a season back then. There was Rod Langway won a Norris Trophy in a year where Ray Bourque had a tremendous amount of points.
Right.
But another one for 87-88, I, again, could be wrong, because I was not born until the end of that year, but May 22nd of 88, but I believe that's the year Craig Janney showed up and went point per game to finish off the regular season and then stepped in and had a really nice playoff.
Yep. Not the guy I was thinking of. I was going to say Reggie Lemelin, Janney was tremendous.
I loved Reggie.
Reggie. I mean, the whole Reggie. And it was so interesting because, you know, the Bruins traded for Andy Moog that year. And he was brought in after the Olympics, and they gave up a lot. They gave up Jeff Courtnall, and he had just scored a hat trick. His last game as a Bruin, he scored a hat trick against Minnesota. I remember because I was at that game. And then literally 2 days later, he was traded, and people were like, what? Because he had like 36 goals or something at the time when Sinden traded him. Just a great year for Jeff Courtnall. But Moog could not supplant Lemelin. And Moog's time came later, and he became a beloved goalie in his own right for the Bruins. And certainly, you know, trivia question, who's the number two all-time winningest playoff goalie for the Bruins after Jerry Cheevers? It's Andy Moog, because he racked up all those wins during that era when the Bruins were couldn't quite win the Stanley Cup, but they were coming close. But anyway,
and
I digress.
And that mask. That mask was awesome.
Yeah. But it was Lemelin was the guy in 88 who really, you know, when you don't want to talk about who you associate really being the face of beating the Canadians for that first emotional time, it was really Reggie Lemelin. Because Moog actually started the series, game one in Montreal. There was a power outage, shocker, although it happened. It happened at the Forum, not in Boston Garden. And I remember I couldn't see the game. I was watching a screen, you know, a TV 38 had just a screen grab picture, and it was a really bad audio. It sounded like it was at the bottom of a Coke can. And, And Moog was in net, and he got pretty soundly defeated. And they went with Lemelin in game two, and the rest, as they say, is history. He won a barn burner to even the series, and then the Bruins won the next two games at home to take a 3-1 stranglehold. One of those was a shutout. I believe Rick Middleton scored the winning goal in that game. He it was a breakaway. He scored to make it 1-0, and then Gordy Kluzak tallied an empty netter. And then the game five back at the Forum, where the Bruins closed them out, 2 goals from Stevie Kasper, 2 goals from Cam Neely, and 45 years of futility melting away. Pretty amazing run. And some would say that was Boston's Stanley Cup, and they just didn't have the energy to go up against, to go up against the Oilers. But I don't think anyone was beating the Oilers that year.
No.
They were just a powerhouse.
That series got me in a whole hell of a lot of trouble with my wife, who I readily admit was a huge Montreal Canadiens fan. So don't ask me how we had like 30 plus years of marriage. But yeah. after the Bruins won game two, and Reed, you may be too young to remember this, but after the Bruins won game two, I went out and bought a big screen TV. And I mean, those things were huge boxes. It took like 5 people to carry it, right? That's how bulky and heavy they were.
I do remember those, yeah.
I went out and bought a big screen TV, and was she mad. She wouldn't watch the game with me on the big screen TV for the rest of the series. And when it was all done and said and over with, she says, well, she finally talked to me and she says, you know what? I want this wicker set down that you went out and bought a big screen TV. So I had to go out and buy her this wicker set that cost more than the damn TV did.
Well, there you go. But you did it. Because you had to make peace. Do you remember who scored the winning goal for the Bruins in that game two? The immortal player that scored. In my mind, he forever became a cult hero of mine. I've had several of his game-worn sweaters over the years, although I don't have any anymore. I wish I did. But do you remember who that was, Don?
Oh.
Not the whole spot. Mo LeMay. Ottawa 67, right? Great. That dude, you want to talk about that? So right, he scored that winning goal. I think he had 2 in that game. Just tremendous, just stepping up, unbelievable performance for a guy who was acquired from the Oilers. For a song. I don't even remember who they traded
for. Yeah, I was just going to ask you. I can't remember who they traded for.
It was one of these very... I want to say it was Alan May for Mo LeMay. Don't quote me. I could be wrong. But it was something like that. And he gets the goals. And then I remember reading an article in the Boston Globe. He had left his family back in Edmonton because it was a late season trade. It was like right at the trade deadline, and they had like strange rules back then. I don't even know that there was a trade deadline that was the way it was, today. So the Bruins had gotten him really late in the season, and he left his family. And so he was living in a hotel, and he called for a pizza. And when they asked for his name, he said, his last name, he said, LeMay. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, "You related to the guy on the Bruins?" And Mo LeMay said, "I am the guy on the Bruins." needless to say, the pie was free. The second pie was free, and several people accompanied the delivery man to meet Mr. LeMay's acquaintance.
That's awesome!
Yeah, I just looked it up. You're right, Kurt. March the 8th, 1988. Alan May for Mo LeMay.
Yeah, there you go. I knew it was. And you know what? That's the study. When you want to talk about why does Ludicky have the passion he does, for the Bruins and for this game, you can thank people like, Fran Rosa and Kevin Paul DuPont and Nancy Marapies Burrell and all of the great writers over the years, the Canadian writers, the American writers that have just, have chronicled the game in that fashion. I mean, that Mo LeMay story I think, is a perfect way to end a great podcast, because it really, you know, the game is so much more than the superstars, and I think our league, unfortunately, has become so beholden to the superstars, and that's a whole nother, you know, it's a slick marketing operation, and I give them all the credit. But let's there's a lot of been a lot of great hockey games won over the years by the likes of Mo LeMay and some of these guys that just, you know, sell out to play the game they love and are lunch pail guys and just find ways to make it, you know, get it done. So I'm grateful to guys like Mo LeMay for really, you know, invigorating me with the love of the sport and the love of the team. And, you know, I hope that people these days will have, you know, similar experiences and similar hockey heroes, to the degree that I had. I've lived a charmed life and had a lot of great experiences over the years, you know, being around the game first as a fan and now as someone that, you know, is more than that.
Well said, Kirk.
Beautiful.
All right, guys. Well, hey, our 1 hour podcast turned into an hour and a half, but I think if anybody here is still hanging out, listening to this, and I'm sure they are, they probably got some good laughs as we did. Again, gentlemen, thank you so much. Great. Again, we want to thank Jesse Gabriel for coming on and joining us for the first 25-30 minutes or so. Again, Boston Bruins, it's an interesting season. It's a lot like what we kind of thought. It's up and down. Let's try to do another one of these here before too long, and maybe a World Junior Championship edition, and maybe we can get another player or celebrity guest on to join us. What do you say, guys?
I'm up for it anytime, Kurt.
Okay.
I thought I was the celebrity. I'm on TV.
You are. You are. You are the ringer. And I promise you, the next one of these we do, Reed, you're going to have the lead. What do you say? You can start putting in the back of your mind and doing the prep work you need to be the lead sled dog. What do you say?
Oh, geez. Well, that would be an honor. I tell you, I can't tell you how much I enjoy doing these with you two guys. I'm so glad that we started doing these, and I have so much fun talking about the Bruins and the history of the team and just the history of hockey with you guys. It's just a blast.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks, guys. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun. Dom, I'll let you take us home.
I just want to say I know how much fans appreciate it, and I get messages all the time, can you do another one, can you do another one? Unfortunately, life gets in the way sometimes, and, you know, we do the best we can for everybody, and I hope you find this enjoyable, and keep on listening. There's more to come. We just can't do this once a week. Unfortunately, we all have other lives we have to lead. So I appreciate, and I'm sure you too as well, the people that do tune in and listen.
All right. Well, for Dominic Tiano, Reed Duthie, and myself, Kirk Ludeke, thank you for joining another Scouting Post Three Amigos podcast. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever you happen to celebrate. Enjoy the time with your families. Enjoy the time with your favorite hockey team. And we are out of here. That Christmas magic brought this tale to a bear.